Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author was recounting the glacial history of North America and the history of when people and dogs first came onto this continent. We resume with episode 14 of Suburban Safari on page 141. The wolves in my yard must have raised their muzzles and sniffed hard the first time they saw dogs, not to mention the bizarre creatures that walked beside the dogs, walked upright like plucked crows. Both new animals probably reeked of stale smoke and dead wildlife. Actually, gray wolves and dogs may have moved toward my yard at the same time, once retreating ice and sea made room for a food chain. They may even have overlapped with the fading dire wolf if he, too, drifted north with the returning forests. When this happened is controversial. Who crossed the broad expanse of tundra from Asia to Alaska and when? Did they have to wait for the glaciers to part? Or did they skirt the coast? On foot? Or in boats? Did some of them hop across tropical islands further south? Evidence of the stone and bone variety argues for a few pulses of immigration across the northern route. But evidence is sparse. The sea has risen again since then, swallowing the coastal sites where people would have left their garbage and broken tools. Bits of evidence hint that people may have peopled the Americas as early as 30,000 years ago. In my yard, the glacier simplifies history. People couldn't have been here until there was land to inhabit, about 13,000 years ago. The first sign of them turns up 1,000 years thereafter. But they, too, are a hard bunch to read, says David Sanger, an anthropologist at the University of Maine. They left behind Clovis points, stone spearheads, and not much else. We have fluted points from 100 different sites, he says, but we have only a half a dozen good artifacts with those points. Did they have a caribou diet? Well, I'm sure they ate whatever they could find, he says with a helpless shrug. As for proof, bones are prone to dissolve in Maine's acidic soil, and pottery, which is more durable, hadn't been invented here yet. Sanger has come down to the coast from Orono to peruse my neighborhood from a Paleo-Indian perspective. He's a tall, soft-spoken man with hair, glasses, and clothing all in shades of silver and beige. A trace of an English accent peeks out of various words. He says that one thing the Clovis points do confirm is that the first Indians in Maine knew their rocks. Almost without exception, the points are made from chert, a stone that takes a sharp edge. It's a stone that's uncommon in Maine, so the folks in my yard also knew their trade routes. If you're living here, Sanger says, tapping an aerial photograph of my neighborhood, how are you going to get your hands on that kind of rock? You might make periodic trips up to Munsungan Lake, where there's an outcrop, but that's 300-something miles. Now, say your in-laws live in northern Maine, and you have periodic reunions with their band. They might bring you something neat that you can use as a gift, like my mother-in-law might bring me a pie. Stone from 5 different states turned up in one Paleo-Indian site. These people had a lot of family reunions. But the family that chipped chert together vanished together. The Paleo-Indian culture blinks out after just 1,500 years. The archaic period from 10,000 to 3,000 years ago is even more obscure. At first, the tools are made from crummy local rock, ground, and pecked into shape. It can be made into tools, but it isn't pretty, Sanger says. They probably used points that were organic, antler and bone. The people were still mobile, but instead of trading rocks, they were trading squashes. A site on the Piscataquis River has coughed up a 6,000-year-old fragment of gourd. That family of plants was domesticated in Central and South America a few thousand years earlier and flourished in southeastern North America perhaps 5,000 years ago. So this fragment has quite a story to tell. The new folks also left behind remnants of a fish trap in the mud of a lake. I'm frustrated by the fact that the archaeological record is skewed toward people living in the interior of Maine. Here on the coast, people may have been writing E equals MC squared and eating soufflés 6,000 years ago, but I'll never know about it. At that time, the glaciers were still melting, so the sea level was still rising. If a coastal archaic person forgot his novel at the beach 6,000 years ago, today that book lies a good 5 miles offshore. The rising tide slowed 5,000 years ago, preserving only the most recent coastal sites for archaeologists. Those sites tell of a culture with sufficient maritime savvy to catch a swordfish and the culinary sophistication necessary to appreciate foot-long oysters, whose shells are preserved in middens beside the Damariscotta River 50 miles up the coast. Although the interior and coastal people pursued different dietary paths and used different tools, Sanger says they were united in one spiritual practice. For most of this period, people all over New England buried their dead in distinct cemeteries, gave them ritual tools, and powdered them with red ochre. Around here, it was the first evidence of what Sanger refers to as a cosmological and spiritual centrality. But contrasts between the interior and coastal cultures persisted. Consistently, coastal people twisted their string in one direction, while inlanders twisted theirs in the other. And based on limited archaeological evidence, the coastal people, gasp, allowed their dogs to chew animal bones. Among many North American hunters, that was taboo. The explanation was that it insulted prey animals, who would henceforth hide themselves from hunters. But in coastal sites, bones of deer, beaver, and other animals appear to be dog-gnawed. Sanger turns his attention on an aerial photo spread on my kitchen table. He taps the dark ponds I found in the woods a couple blocks inland from my house. These are where you'd find edible cattails and lily bulbs. It would also attract ducks, snakes, muskrats, turtles, and deer that would come to water. Then he fingers the beach. At low tide, you'd have clam flats. He grins. Clams don't get no respect. There's not much to them besides water. But women, children, and even old people can gather shellfish. I like to imagine people grumbling about clams again. But they're dipping them into fatty deer broth. He studies the map again. You're protected from northwest winds. You can beach your canoe and be pretty close to water. As for lobster, currently the most coveted food in Casco Bay, Sanger has never found lobster shell in Indian garbage heaps. Yet I've read European accounts of Maine Indians harving lobsters that weighed 20 pounds. They dried them like jerky and used them for fishing bait. The European settlers fished with lobster meat, too, and used them for garden fertilizer when the crustaceans washed up after a storm. Today, we use fish for lobster bait. Times change. The most recent Indian in my neck of the woods were, according to the reports of European explorers, the Almuchicoi or Armuchicoi. In contrast to Mainers to their north and east, these folks were farmers, which afforded them a sedentary, town-building lifestyle. This didn't endear them to their neighbors, with whom they feuded. Armuchicoi, according to the best guess of historians, is a derogatory term that means dog people. Enough about people. What were their dogs like? They may have looked like Carolina dogs. The Carolina dog was discovered only recently, running wild at the isolated Savannah River plutonium enrichment site. For decades, people in Georgia, South Carolina, and Florida have rescued the toast-colored puppies from roadsides without giving much thought to their origin. Now the dogs are being bred intentionally. When I set eyes on my first Carolina dog photograph, I'm a goner. The United Kennel Club specifies that a Carolina dog should bear an expression of softness and intelligence. And they do. They're lithe creatures with huge eyes. The muzzle is delicate. The big ears stand up. The legs are long, built for sprinting after squirrels and pouncing on frogs. The tail ends in a quirky fish hook. Overall, the dog looks like a dainty dingo. Same white toes and tail tip, same tall ears. DNA analysis, superficial so far, encourages the fantasy. The Carolina dog may be an archaic Canis familiaris who, like the dingo, the malamute, and a few others, is minimally diluted with European dog genes. Like other primitive dogs, Carolina dogs dig dens and regurgitate food for their pups. When I search for historical accounts of Indian dogs, I find that European explorers often noted a fine muzzle and an overall appearance that suggested a coyote or small wolf. Colors ran the gamut, as they still do in Carolina dogs. Then again, just as frequently as Euros described the Carolina dog model, they described other things. In Marion Schwartz's A History of Dogs in the Early Americas, I find reports of wolfy dogs, foxish dogs, coyote look-alikes, and the popular short-nosed Indian dog, which was a foot-high model reported from coast to coast and south to Peru. Often I read of a tribe keeping two breeds of dog, one the size of a small terrier, the other comparable to a wolf or a coyote. Numerous Europeans, from numerous locations, reported that Indians encouraged the larger dog to mate with wolves, which are stronger, pound for pound, than domestic dogs. Some observers commented that the big Indian dogs were distinct from wolves only in that they were silent, or barked instead of howling. Among dog illustrations, I find two 1840 etchings from a collection called A Naturalist's Library. The one titled Dogs of the North American Indians shows a pair of Carolina dogs. Perhaps the head is a little broader, but other than that, even the soft and intelligent look is present. A companion etching with palm trees and cordillera in the background presents two more breeds. The yellow carrier dog of the Indians is large and stout of leg, ear, and muzzle. The tricolor alco is one-third as big, with folded ears. If the European reports are accurate, the dog-human relationship of a few hundred years ago echoed the modern range. Many Indian tribes trained dogs to hunt, everything from elk to bison, turkeys to beavers, even seals, depending upon the ecosystem. Some dogs were coddled for sacrifice to the gods. Many more were fattened for the family pot or the market. The Spaniards, Schwartz reports in his History of Dogs, ate oodles of these on their American explorations. At the other end of the spectrum, many Indians observed taboos against dog eating. They sheltered their dogs indoors and loved them like family members. Women sometimes nursed puppies at their own breast. Occasionally, archaeologists find dogs who were buried with as much care as were people. Sometimes a beloved dog was killed to join a master or mistress in the grave. In Arizona's White Dog Cave, mummies from about A.D. 100 preserve a family structure. Mummy man was found lying beside a big white dog. Mummy woman was accompanied by a small spotted dog. But on the timeline of people and dogs in the Americas, most of this evidence is recent. The Asian invasion by people and dogs stretched over thousands of years and any number of different lifestyles. The man-dog relationship from that period is a mystery, and shortly after Europeans discovered the Indian dogs were diluted nearly out of existence, leaving even less information to work with. After Asian dogs and their people walked into North America, the dire wolf checked out. But the other canids stuck around in what must have been a strained coexistence. Undoubtedly, Indians killed some wolves, and wolves ate some dogs, and dogs ate some foxes. Dogs may even have eaten a few wolves. Wolves probably ate a few people. In the West, coyotes joined the melee. It was a jittery community, but nobody went extinct, not until a new wave of people washed onto the continent from the opposite direction. The easterly series of immigrations deposited European men and dogs in the Caribbean and the east coast of North America. This time, the dogs were trained to hunt men, not elk and rabbits. Spaniards set their mastiffs and greyhounds on those Caribbean and American Indians whom they deemed troublesome, immoral, or simply expendable. Schwartz reports that Spanish explorers sometimes traveled with Indian slaves, whom they butchered for dog food. Depraved as the Spanish were, there was plenty of violence to go around. It was not a gentle time. Many Indian tribes were accustomed to bashing enemy women and children on the head. The removal of captives' ears for the captives' own consumption seems to have fallen within the rules of war for some tribes. And various European chroniclers reported cannibalism in some tribes. Many Indian tribes were as accomplished in the slaving business as the Europeans were. In my flaking 1835 edition of Drake's Indians of North America, I read that European men did a brisk trade in young Indian women, while Indians enjoyed having a Frenchman around to fetch food and water. But even in this harsh context, those rumbling war dogs must have given Indians nightmares. The Indian population soon crumbled to a shred of the pre-European number through smallpox and other plagues. Many survivors fled the great dying that beset my neighborhood, moving east or north to Canada. The remaining Indians and Europeans behaved peaceably for about 50 years. The wolves, and bears too, refused, however, to check their murderous tendencies toward the Europeans' pigs, and the foxes were charmed, I'm sure, by their introduction to domestic fowl. The wild canids soon made the acquaintance of the trap and gun. Like the Indians, they began to retreat and die out. As for the Indian dogs in my area, they were probably accused of taking European livestock, as they were elsewhere. And they surely interbred with European farm dogs. For a while, though, the surviving dog people and their dogs carried on with daily life, innocent of the fact that an English king had essentially deeded New England to a trading company. But the Europeans spread. If the large animals of the Ice Age displayed a fatal innocence toward two-legged predators, the Indians showed a similar innocence with regard to real estate predators. Up and down the coast now, Europeans were clearing and planting, logging and shipping, and allowing their cows to mash Indian cornfields. The Indians got the picture. Those pink-cheeked critters with their four-legged livestock were going to eat them out of house and home. Hostilities broke out across New England. Indians torched farms. The French joined the Indians against the English. In my neighborhood, my Anglo predecessors scurried to a newly constructed fort. The French lured them out with a promise of safe conduct to a nice English town, but then hiked most of them to Canada and sold them, presumably as servants to French Canadians. Survivors retreated 40 miles south to Wells. When the last homestead had burned, my neighborhood was its old self for a time. pasture pine, and birches shot up in the fields. 10 years later, under one of many peace agreements, the English came back. Then 5 years later came more war, slaughter, and captive taking. So it went for 60 years, with alternating terror and peace. In my yard, the politics likely played out as alternating pines and pasture, pines and pasture. But with each round, the Indians grew more hungry and less numerous. Their corn was vulnerable to European flames and animals. The Europeans refused to sell them powder and shot, for fear it would be returned to them at high velocity. Even dogs were withheld from the Indians, and they seemed to have forgotten how to hunt without guns. The immigrants continued to gnaw into the woods, claiming, taming, and renaming. It was a long struggle, with enough horror to scar a nation to the bone. In my neighborhood, as in most yards throughout the Americas, the Indians and their dogs lost. Once they ruled my backyard. Now I can scarcely reconstruct who they were. The closest I get to their dogs is a painting from 1855. It depicts canoeing Micmacs, one of the Armouchikois' feuding neighbors. Dozing outside the birch bark teepee in the background are two, well, Carolina dogs. For many decades after the Indians were gone, my yard was probably a bleak pasture. In photographs from the mid-1800s, the land looks close-shaven, presumably by unfenced livestock. Trees are scarce. Houses, for that matter, are rare. They stand like clapboard boxes on a warped table. Dirt trails link them together. On a map from about the same era, my street doesn't exist. Just 15 buildings are sketched on the 6-block area where today more than 100 stand. Most of the land, including my lot, is open. I suspect it was an orchard or pasture belonging to one of the Willard clan, whose various homesteads are nearest. In Captain Benjamin Willard's autobiography, I find signs that my yard was already, in the mid-1800s, destined for suburbhood. In the illustrations intended to showcase the captain's trained pets, besides inducing Spot, the Dalmatian, to climb onto his head, Willard trained a cedar waxwing bird to perch on Spot's circus headgear. I find signs that the sun has set on the day of scratching a living from a wild land. One room is tricked out with elaborate moldings. Wall-to-wall carpeting covers the floor. The captain himself appears sleek and well-stuffed, not a man of manual labor. His personal economy was so robust that he left a monument to Spot when the dog died. Spot went blind at 15, and a doctor etherized him. Then Captain Willard had him buried on my lot with a $50 headstone. On an afternoon with low clouds and hardening ground, I search for this plot up on Meeting House Hill. In the shadow of the captain's granite alp stands an arched slab. Carved on it is a dog, his forepaws engaged in rolling a barrel. "Trained dog Spot," the stone reads. If the wolves, who once howled in my yard, could see what their tame cousins stooped to, they would surely curl a lip. But by Spot's time in the late 1800s, wolves had been hounded out of state. The wolves were part of a trend. The number of different animals and plants that could make a living in my yard had been shrinking since the first people and dogs sauntered in 12,000 years ago. All the dire wolves, primitive horses, camels, and mastodons who chased the shrinking glacier north had gone extinct. Then, when the Europeans arrived, nearly every tree in the state was felled. In the open pastures, few plants could compete with the imported grasses that fed imported horses, sheep, goats, and cows. And few wild animals could survive on that carpet of grass. But when suburbs sprouted in the fields, this trend towards sterility stopped, then shifted into reverse. Suburbanites wanted trees, they wanted flowers, and they either didn't want, or weren't allowed, livestock. Backyards became oases of diversity. Granted, as often as not, the plants people embedded in their yards were native to Asia, not New England. But they looked good to many a hungry insect and seed-seeking mouse. Bigger creatures adapted more slowly to the new landscape. Coyotes won't normally share territory with wolves, but people had pushed wolves deep into Canada and Mexico. The yellow canines came sniffing east. Nocturnal and audacious, they're concluding that life near people is tolerable. It doesn't hurt that suburbanites are forbidden to trap or shoot them. Now, instead of wolves howling over the settlers' pigs, coyotes yammer over the cats and dogs in the same neighborhood. White-tailed deer take a similar view. As fewer people hunt, an exploding deer population is prancing deep into the suburbs, where food is abundant. Ditto crows and gray squirrels, and the other night a neighbor spotted a moose rambling through the graveyard where trained dog Spot lies. The resurgence of Animalia puts me in mind of post-glacial rebound. Farming and lumbering kept the land nearly empty of wildlife. Now, drained of agri-industry, the land is filling with creatures again. The most recent native to investigate my area is the wild turkey. Hunted nearly to extinction, the portly birds now dally on suburban roads and raid bird feeders. A friend who works in a suburban office building emails me photos of them sitting on cars in the parking lot. Even that old-time canine, the wolf, is drifting back toward town, striking out from a base near the Canadian border. In Maine, the first wolf to be spotted in a century was shot in 1993 by a bear hunter who may have lacked a clear concept of what a bear is. The next one got to the coast before it was trapped, then shot. It could be a slow return, but how interesting if they should survive the gauntlet of guns, traps, and coyote snares, if they should find enough to eat to support their trip south. Wolves lived cheek by jowl with Indians. Only relentless persecution by Europeans with cheap bullets, traps, and poison drove them away. Without that persecution, perhaps wolves, too, will find the suburban lifestyle to their liking. Stranger things have happened. In the suburbs of Boulder and other western cities, mountain lions recently discovered grass-fed deer, then diversified their diet to include cats and dogs, and even the occasional Homo sapiens. How interesting to wake in the street-lighted suburbs to hear the silver wail of a wolf, to find those big paw prints on the first snow, to spot among the weeds not a disemboweled sparrow but the glossy black hoof of a deer, then the tawny leg. Up the hill, trained dog Spot is surely rolling in his grave. That's all we have time for on this edition of the Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is the Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.